This episode of the Disney Nerds Podcast is brought to you by TouringPlans.com. Spend less time in line and more time riding your favorite attractions. Visit TouringPlans.com.
Hey everybody, it's Stacy from Must Do Disney, and you are in the place to be, the Disney Nerds Podcast. Check it out.
Welcome to the splendor, the spectacle, the sparkling sensation, where the romance, the comedy, and the thrill of Disney fantasies come to electric life.
And as our friend Jiminy said, welcome. Welcome to the Disney Nerds Podcast, a place each week where like-minded people get together to discuss all things Disney. We'll help you get your Disney fix on. Here we go.
The Magic Kingdom proudly presents, in a million points of musical light, the magical worlds of Disney.
Hello and welcome to show number 357 of the Disney Nerds Podcast. Hey guys, how's it going? And welcome back to the show. On this week's show, well, we're just back from 2 weeks off. And I tell you what, I think we're going to bring you a little Walt Disney. One of the things we like to do on the show, along with a lot of talk and rides and things like that, news and such, we like to bring some interviews of Walter Elias Disney. We figure everything started with Walt. And this interview is a perfect example of how that works. The interview was given by Fletcher Markle in 1963. Now, this was, a little bit of a marketing ploy because Markle was the director of The Incredible Journey. Remember that movie with the two dogs and the cat that kind of have to go across country to catch up with their family? They redid it later on with Michael J. Fox and some other characters, but this was the original one way back in 1963. Well, Markle had interviewed Walt, and this was a pretty good interview. It starts out really nice, too, because Markle kind of comments about how Walt's the creator of the mouse, and Walt spends a couple minutes reminding him that he actually had been working a long time before he came up with Mickey Mouse. And we do hear a little bit about that. We hear some more about what's going on at the company. We hear about the incredible journey. We get into, of course, some animatronics, because how can you not? And it's a really, really good interview. Okay, guys, so we're going to go ahead with that interview. Before I do, I just want to thank you guys for hanging with the Disney Nerds Podcast. We're going to be back on schedule with a lot of great shows, a lot of great interviews, and a lot of surprises. So look forward to that. And without further ado, Fletcher Markle and Walter Disney, take it away, guys.
Well, you're a man who's famous for many things, not the least is building a better mouse. The world has been beat out of the door for 35 years. I'm dating the beginning of that path, of course, from 1928 and the release of Steamboat Willie, the picture that introduced sound to the cartoon and Mickey Mouse to the world. Was it actually the first cartoon in which Mickey appeared?
Yes, in which Mickey appeared, yes, But I was making cartoons long before that. In fact, I think I've been in this business about as long as anybody living today. I started actually in the, to make my first animated cartoons, 1920. Of course, they're very crude things then, and I used old sort of little puppet things. We didn't draw them like we do today. I used to make little cutout things, and joints were pinned, and we'd put them under the camera, and we'd maneuver them and make them do things. And
this was before you came to Hollywood, actually.
Oh, yes, this started back in Kansas City, Missouri, where I was working in the, made the little advertisements for theaters. It's equivalent to what you see in TV commercials today, you know?
Uh-huh.
Put your winter coat in early, you know? Get your, fedora block for the winter and all those kinds of things. Get your, this was back in the days when they had the old canvas tops on cars. Get your top renewed.
Necessary, of course.
Yeah. And there was one little thing I did there. You had to think up little gags, little catch things, you know. So I had this spanking, shining car drive in. I had a character on the street. He hailed the driver, and he says, "Hi, old top, new car?" And the guy in the car says, "No, old car, new top." Then we go into the pitch of the where to get them renewed and all that stuff.
Well, I was dating Steamboat Willie simply because it was, Mickey's first appearance, and also the first introduction of sound to the cartoon. Now, in the case of Steamboat Willie, I suppose sometimes picture came first and sometimes sound came first. Or was it always picture first?
No, in the days of Steamboat Willie, it was picture first. And then we used to put the sound on afterwards. And in those days, you couldn't do what we call dubbing today, where you could mix a lot of tracks. And it wasn't yet the science that you could get away with. So we used to have to do everything at one time. And we used to have to run the cartoon. We'd have the fellows with the sound effects. We had the people with the voices. We had the orchestra going, and everybody had to synchronize and hit that thing right on the button. And we had a way of doing it, though. We had a little kind of a little beat that worked up and down, and there was so many of those beats, you know, and they were all musicians working for me, so they could follow those beats. And when it came to a certain number of beats, they would go ah, or they would go bang, or they would go this, or they would pop one of these pop guns, you know, and it would always fit.
It was kind of opening night for everybody.
Oh, yeah, it was so mad.
About the Leeches building a better mouse.
After Steamboat Willie, of course, came the Silly Symphonies. So many of them so happily remembered. And not quite 10 years after Steamboat Willie, we saw Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. First feature-length cartoon.
Yes, just about 10 years.
How long was it in production, Walt?
I actually started to plan the picture in 1935. And I fooled around with it, trying to get a hold of a story and things for a couple of years, and finally it began to gel. Then I went to work on it. I finished it the fall of 1938. And I didn't know what I had or what would happen or anything. We had the family fortune. We had everything wrapped up in Snow White. In fact, the banker, I think, was losing more sleep than I was. And fortunately, we put it in, premiered it, and everything else. Why, everything was fine. The banker was happy.
And the following spring along came that Academy Award.
It wasn't but about 2 years later that I was almost broke.
Well, 2 years later
again.
Was following Pinocchio and coming into the Fantasia period.
Yeah, that about did it, you know.
But that was a new
artistic success, financial failure.
Certainly an artistic success. It was a magnificent.
Well, some people would question that, too.
And I recall a new and musical Mickey standing in for Leopold Stokowski.
Well, that's what started. I was doing this Sorcerer's Apprentice with Mickey Mouse, and I happened to have dinner one night with Stokowski. And Stokowski said, oh, I would love to conduct that for you, you know? Well, that led to not only doing this one little short subject, but it got us involved where I did all of Fantasia, and before I knew it, I ended up spending $400,000+ getting music with Stokowski. But we were in then. It was a point of no return. We would have made it.
It was certainly worth it every foot of the way.
Well, he's a great guy, though. I don't want to belittle Stokowski, but he is a great musician, a great artist.
Well, perfectionism always costs money, I guess, and that's certainly something you've always been after.
Well, I was always known as the perfectionist until I met Stokowski.
And you had a new member of the club, indeed. Well, about a year after the release of Fantasia, Robert Benchley, I remember, joined you in explaining to audiences all over the world how you go about making a cartoon. What are the principal technical advances since that time?
Well, better drawing. First thing I did when I got a little money to experiment, I put all my artists back in school. The art schools that existed then didn't quite have enough for what we needed, so we set up our own art school.
Well, you were inventing a new art anyway.
Well, yes, but we were just going a little bit beyond what they were getting in the art school, where they work with the static figure. Now, we were dealing in motion, movement, and the flow of movement, the flow of things, you know. Action, reaction, all of that. So we had to set up our own school. And out of that school have come the artists that now make up my staff here, and more than that, the artists that make up most all of the cartoon outfits in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Where directly or indirectly out of my school.
Well, of course, everything is people, and it was the individual and collective talents of these artists. I was only asking if there had been a technical advance in that your own work in the cartoon field seems to have acquired so much more depth and so much more.
Yes, there are many technical advances, but basically the thing that gives us more depth is our the ability to draw the way it should be drawn for this medium. You get a lot of depth out of the way you shape a line, the way you draw the figures. That contributes an awful lot to the depth and to the overall effect that you see today with the cartoon.
Now, in the early 1940s, we saw Saludos Amigos and a little later the Three Caballeros, the latter being the first combination of live action and cartoons. Tell us a little about how those two pictures came into being.
So which one, the Saludos Amigos?
I presume kind of led you to the Three Caballeros.
I was asked by the government to go to South America and kind of a cultural thing, you know, before the, those Nazi days.
Yes.
And I went down with the staff to see if I couldn't make some films about the ABC countries down there. You know, there's Argentina, Brazil, and Chile. And they first wanted me to go on a handshaking goodwill tour, and I said, I'm not a good handshaker and everything. And then they came back and said, well, you go down and make some films about these countries. I said, well, that's my business. I can do that.
Take a pencil in your hand.
That's right. So I took a staff, and we set up headquarters in Rio. We also went and set up a studio in the Argentine. We went over to Chile, and some of my artists, we divided a party. Some of them went up to Peru. And when we came back, I made these four short subjects. We brought back the Tico Tico tune that was being played down there, and I brought that back and put it in. Brought back Brazil, and both of them became standard tunes.
Okay. Here.
And out of it, we developed this little Brazilian parrot, Jose Carioca, who played with Donald Duck. Anyways, these four films were more or less put together, and they went out in the theater. And of course, it was one of those things that they thought Disney needed the subsidy, but, you know, fortunately, that little thing went out, and it did a heck of a business, and the United States government didn't have to put up one nickel.
How wonderful.
It was actually a goodwill tour for the government.
And it was later, about 2 years later, that the Three Caballeros then became the new
project.
That
was a follow-up, yeah.
Combining live action.
Yeah. I almost need the subsidy on that one.
Well, I gather that Mary Poppins, currently in production, is a further development of the combination of live action and cartoon.
Yes, you might say that. We have a sequence in Mary Poppins that where we have the live characters in with the animated drawings. But basically, Mary Poppins is a live musical fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
The whole story is carried out by live actors. And it's, of course, we have a lot of tricks of the trade here that we incorporated into Mary Poppins, such as they fly around and all of that kind of stuff, you know. But still, it's basically a live-action musical fantasy.
Well, after
with a wonderful cast, by the way.
Well, let's change the subject for a few minutes, Walt, from film activities to outside activities. Perhaps I should say outdoors activities. I'd like to talk to you about Disneyland. Where did you originally get the first notion for Disneyland?
Well, it came about when my daughters were very young, and Saturday was always Daddy's Day with the two daughters. So we'd start out and try to go someplace with, you know, different things, and I take them to the merry-go-round, and I took them different places. And as I'd sit there while they rode the merry-go-round, did all these things, sit on a bench, you know, eating peanuts, I felt that there should be something built, some kind of an amusement enterprise built where that the parents and the children could have fun together. So that's how Disneyland started. Well, it took many years. It was a whole period of maybe 15 years developing. I started with many ideas, threw them away, started all over again, and eventually it evolved into what you see today as Disneyland. But it all started from a daddy with two daughters wondering where he could take them, where he could have a little fun with them, too. Four adults to one child. That is, we're counting, though, the teenagers as adults.
Of course.
But, of course, in the wintertime, you can go out there during the week and you won't see any children. You'll see all the oldsters out there riding all these rides and having fun and everything. Summertime, of course, the average would drop down, but the Well, year-round average, it's 4 adults to 1 child.
And, of course, there, in my knowledge, there's only been one adult who's been refused permission to the park.
No, we didn't refuse them permission. No, we were all set. You see, we work according to what the State Department wants to do. When they come in, they have guests. If he's Khrushchev was a guest of the government. So, I mean, we were ready to receive Khrushchev. But it so happened that the security problem here in Los Angeles, because actually Disneyland is in another county, you see, and the chief of police, we can't blame him. He had quite a chore there to carry out. He just was a little worried about somebody maybe walking in Disneyland with a shopping bag and what they might have in it. You'd never be able to know, you know.
Exactly. And it's...
But we were ready for him. The press was ready. Both the State Department security and the Soviet security had come and cased Disneyland, and they were all set. And I was all ready. And in fact, we've had a lot of dignitaries down there. And,
I should
and
say.
He was one that Mrs. Disney wanted to go down and meet, was Khrushchev. Yeah. So she was disappointed he didn't come.
Well, it's certainly not ever an empty place, so I can understand the security men's concern.
We had different shots, places where we take pictures with Khrushchev, and I had one, my favorite, where I we lined up in front of my 8 submarines, you see, and I thought, well, it'd be nice. I've been pointing to Mr. Khrushchev, saying, well, now, Mr. Khrushchev, here's my Disneyland submarine fleet. It's the eighth largest submarine fleet in the world.
Is it really? Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to be seeing part of the tour that the submarines make presently, so it's interesting to hear about. What was the initial cost of the Disneyland that first saw the light of day?
Oh, it goes back so far. I had different cost estimates. One time it was $3.5 million, and then I kept fooling around with it and got up to $7.5 million, and I kept fooling around a little more, and pretty soon it was $12.5 million, and I think when we opened Disneyland, it was $17 million.
And then it grew like Topsy.
Today, it is going on $45 million.
My gosh. Well, now, today, the newest and most exciting aspect of Disneyland is what... I've turned this over on my tongue several times. What you call audio animatronics.
Yes, audio animatronic figures. It's a sort of another door that's open for us. See, our whole 40-some-odd years here has been in the world of making things move, inanimate things move. Yeah. From a drawing to all kinds of any little props and things. Now we're making these human figures, dimensional human figures move, make animals move, make anything move, through the use of electronics. It's a tape mechanism that... The tape, it's like a programming or sequencing when they do a missile, when they're sending some missile to the moon, say. Yeah. At different stages, at different times, things must happen. That's all programmed, predetermined. So our show is put on that tape, and it's programmed from this tape. And we run it off a little 1-inch tape that has 14 tracks. And on each track, we can get up to 16 signals. Now, those little signals go and impulse this figure... And make the figure move, make the figure talk, and everything. Well, look, I could show it to you a lot better than I can tell you about it. We come over here and I'll give you a little preview.
I should say.
Well, here we are, Fletcher. This is a little audio electronic setup for the park. The park kit, so to speak. Now, these are not working from tape. These are manually controlled. This little gizmo here, kind of like a joystick on the old type airplanes, is what gives us a chance to program the bird. And as we work this and get all the little movements that we want in the bird out, we record it on the tape. And then from then on, the tape will do everything that we've done here. So now we'll have a little go at this thing. Now, this is not part of our Disneyland show. I mean, you know, the Tiki Room. This is a little robin that we had in Mary Poppins. And this little bird sang a duet with Julie Andrews. Maybe we can get a little response from it. Hello there, kid. What can you do for us, huh? Can you sing, whistle, anything? Huh?
That's marvelous. Now, this is one of the characters from the Tiki Room. He's actually a substitute. In other words, if one of our master ceremonies, we had four macaws who act as master ceremonies in the Tiki Bird Room Disneyland. And they actually keep the show rolling. And along with them are other birds who sing and things, and flowers that sing, and then the tiki images, you know, the carved tiki poles and things with these tiki gods. They sing and they drum, and we have quite a show. But this is the boy that takes care of it. In other words, he's the stand-in for one of them, you know.
He's very alert.
Throw out your chest, show him how big your ass is. Now, this is Fletcher Markle of CBC.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name.
Markle.
How do you spell that, sir?
M-A-R-K-L-E.
M-A-R-K Markle.
That's right.
How do you do, sir?
How do you do? Whatever your name is.
What is my name?
Well, I'll tell you the truth, we haven't given them a name yet. How would you like, Jose?
Ah, muchas gracias. This gives me an accent.
How do you do, Jose? Now it's official.
How do you do? Oh, miss my accent.
Well, that's just a little demonstration of audio animatronic figures. See?
Now let me make sure I understand what happens in controlling these birds by these extraordinary instruments.
Mm-hmm.
You can at the same time record their movements on a tape.
That's right. After we get it programmed, it's like rehearsing the show. And you go through it and rehearse it and rehearse it, and you finally say, that's it. And we say, all right, let's go for a take. And as we go for a take, all the things we do here are recorded, and then when we play the tape back, he will do everything he's doing here. Only it's all part of a programmed show, you see?
And I understand then that the next step beyond the birds has been to do the same kind of programming with human beings.
Yes, with human beings, yeah. I'm not going to replace the human being. Believe me, no, just for show purposes, because you take Disneyland down there, we operate 15 hours a day, and these shows have got to go on the hour. Now, my Tiki Bird show goes on three times an hour, and I don't have to stop for coffee breaks and all that kind of stuff, you see? So that's the whole idea of it. It's just another dimension in the animation that we've been doing all our life.
It's
now we're going into dimensional things and everything. It's a new door, it's a new toy for us, and we're having a lot of fun, and we hope we can really do some exciting things in the future.
May I try one here?
Yes, you go right ahead. How about a song then? What about you, Jose? You got anything to say?
Hasta la vista.
That's right, hasta la vista. Well, let's go over and finish our piece.
Right. Well, Walt, let's change the subject again, if we may. I'd like to ask you now about your accomplishments as an international film producer, and that you've made films in how many countries in the world?
Oh, I can't recall, because we've done a lot of our nature films, and we had a series called People and Places, where we went over Japan and different places, even over into the Egyptian area. But I have been basically making films in England first, with our British company,
uh-huh.
And then in Canada. I mean, as you know.
Well, our telescope viewers are naturally interested in your plans for Canada. They remember well, of course, Nikki, the Wild Dog of the North, which I think was your first Canadian production.
Yes, we did that between Calgary and Banff. And we worked with the Canadian Wildlife what would you call it? Canadian Wildlife
Society, I guess.
Is it society? No, it's the government. Anyways, they let us have an experimental station that they had was abandoned or weren't using, and we put our company there, and he went right through the winter, and we got some wonderful stuff on the film.
And then with the second film, you went to eastern parts to make Big Red,
mm-hmm.
for the locations of Big Red. And coming up in the next few days, Canadians are going to be seeing your third Canadian production, The Incredible Journey.
That's Sheila Burnford's best-selling story of this.
It's
one of my favorites. I think the animals in that are terrific. I hate to say that to you, Fletcher, because you directed the humans. I'm always partial to animal actors anyways, you know.
Well, I found the animals pretty pleasant, too, I must say.
But it's certainly the animal picture, and one of the most remarkable animal stories of its kind that I've ever read, let alone had anything to do with as a film. I gather, Walt, that you first found out about the story even before it was published in North America.
Yes.
During its English publication.
Yes, it was first published in England, and we had, that's where we caught on to it.
You had your plans long before it became a bestseller.
Yes, we got into quite a hassle, though, on who, some bidding went on to get that story, and when it all ended up, and I found out it was my good friend George Seaton was bidding against me. George apologized. He said, "I'm sorry I run the price up on you, Walt, but he said, I didn't know you were bidding against me."
These are things you can never know about in advance. Actually, the part of the Canadian story that interests me more than any other is the fact that your father was born in Canada and lived a good part of his life there before he moved to parts to the south and began producing Sons.
Yes, he was born in a little town, I think they call it Bluevale, it's right out of Goderich. And the Disney family were Anglo-Irish, and they migrated over there in the 1830s, which makes me feel that the Disneys had foresight, because it was 1840 when they had the potato famine in Ireland, but they were smart enough to get out before that. And my father was born there, and he was raised there, and went to school there. In fact, he went to school in Goderich. And he was about 20 years old when my grandfather went to Kansas, out in the same area where General Eisenhower, or ex-President Eisenhower, came from. And he was an alien, of course, being a Canadian, and he had to buy his land. He couldn't homestead. And he bought a section of railroad land, and that property stayed with the Disney family until just a few years ago, and my uncle had it, and I told him, I said, before you sell it, let us know. And so finally he wanted to sell it and retire. And I went to my brother, I said, let's buy this virgin land that our ancestors, you know, acquired. And he said, what do we want with farming land? He wouldn't go with me. So I didn't go ahead. I found out later they struck gas and oil on it.
Well, you can't win them all.
No.
Tell me, Walt, have you been back to your father's homestead at all in recent years?
My father and I had planned to go back because as a boy, my father always told me about his boyhood in Canada. And you see here, 4th of July is a big deal here, but my father always referred to the Queen's birthday, and that was Victoria. And that's when they had their big doings, you know. And I always wanted to go up there with my father because, as a youngster, you know, he told me about all these different things that he did in the country. He thought it was the most beautiful country in the world, and yet he'd come down here to live. And he died before we had a chance to do that.
Well, after your father's death, did you finally get a chance to get back up to the old homestead?
Yes, I finally made it. I took Mrs. Disney along. She's not too interested in ancestors and things, you know. When we got up there, she really fell in love with the town of Goderich. It was a beautiful little town. And she was quite happy about it. But I wanted to find the homestead where my grandfather, you know, went out and cut the trees down and pulled the rocks apart, and where my father was born. So they gave me directions, and everybody was trying to be helpful and everything. And Mrs. Disney reluctantly went along. And I found this old place, and I said, this is it. It was really deserted. There were cows running through the house and chickens around. And I had my camera, and I got out, and I photographed that thing from every angle. And when I got through, I found out I'd photographed the wrong homestead. Well, ever since, Mrs. Disney has never forgot. She tells that to everybody about when Walt went up to Canada, and he photographed the wrong homestead, you know.
Well, let's leave that in the past where it properly belongs and look ahead for a moment to the future, Walt. What's on your immediate schedule? I gather there are some projects for the World's Fair in New York.
Yes, they're more or less an extension of Disneyland in a way. We're doing four shows for the World's Fair.
Four?
Yes, it's about $50 million worth of shows that we're doing for the World's Fair. Of course, that includes the cost of the building, the rent of the land, everything. We're doing one for the Ford Motor Company. We're doing one for General Electric. We're doing one for the Pepsi-Cola Company and the state of Illinois.
These are When you say extensions of Disneyland, are any of them audio animatronic?
Yes, audio animatronic and the dimensional type of shows like we do at Disneyland, not film shows. There's no film involved in any of these shows. We use our audio animatronic figures. And at the State of Illinois exhibit, you're going to have great moments with Mr. Lincoln. Mr. Lincoln is going to be there. He's going to speak 5 times an hour. It's going to be very lifelike and very, very believable. And we're finding some wonderful words of Mr. Lincoln that are still prophetic today. And I think it's going to be a great moment for the public when they can sit and hear Mr. Lincoln talk about some of the things. What is liberty? You know, the rights and the obligations that we have and all of that. I think it's needed today, too.
I should say it is. But Walt, it's very difficult to talk about rewards because certainly you've had so many of them, 29 Oscars and nearly 700 other awards from all corners of the world. But personally, what has been your greatest reward to date?
Well, my greatest reward, I think, is that I've been able to build this wonderful organization. I've been able to enjoy good health. And the way I feel today, I feel like I can still go on being a part of this thing after 40-some-odd years in the business. And also to have the public appreciate and accept what I've done all these years. That is a great reward.
I'm sure it is. It seems unlikely, but if you had it to do over again, would you do any part of it differently?
Well, if I had it to do over again, I don't think I would. I don't know. I hope I don't have to do it over again.
There's certainly a completely unique reward in having that feeling about your work and what you've accomplished.
Yes.
That's a reward of satisfaction and happiness, surely.
Yes.
What does happiness mean to you, Walt?
Well, of course, I mean, happiness is a state of mind. I mean, that you can, if you're of your own doing, you can be happy or you can be unhappy. It's just according to the way you look at things, you know. So I think happiness is, contentment, but it doesn't mean you have to have wealth, you know. But all individuals are different. So I wouldn't be satisfied with just carrying out a routine job and being happy. Yet I envy those people. I had a brother who I really envied because he was a mailman. But he had all the fun. He had himself a trailer, and he used to go off and go fishing, and he didn't worry about payrolls and stories and picture grocers or anything. And he was the happy one. I always said, he's the smart Disney.